all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. First up is going to be an interview with Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia. This is a great interview. We talk about the amazing clearing of a house that he did that earned him the Medal of Honor that happened to be almost serendipity. It was recorded on film. And really more about what he learned afterwards when he got together with his brothers in arms during the Medal of Honor ceremony and some insights, funny insights about President Trump. Then we're going to hear about a new law that President Biden signed that is going to help disabled veterans, 100% disabled veterans with mobility problems get auto grants from the VA. Really important stuff when we talk to MPVA President Mike Harris about that. And then we're going to hear a little bit of music and some insights from Jason Jones, an artist out of LA, and how he came to the attention of NVBDC. So enjoy. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia. David, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is an extraordinary story and a unique story that you've told it a couple of times. There's a lot of media on this. But David, in 2004, was with a U.S. Army unit, the Ramrods. And they were in, they were on the, you know, pointy end of the spear at the Second Battle of Fallujah. David's squad, after 3 days of constant fighting, were checking at night, a darkened house. I think it was the 10th house that the squad had gone in to try to clear, and all hell broke loose. Some of that was actually captured on film because there was an embedded reporter. Ultimately, David, as the staff sergeant, decided something's got to be done to protect the guys here, and he went in single-handedly, cleared the house. I think there were four insurgents who were killed and another that was severely wounded. But all of that action was done to get the fire that was raining down on his squad dealt with. And as the NCO, kind of it was his call. He couldn't send anybody else in. This was something he had to do. And that's to some extent what they expected of Sergeant Bell, as he was affectionately known as. David, you've had a chance to recount this story a number of times, but before we get there, give us a little about why you joined the Army to begin with.
So my grandfather, who I'm blessed to still have my life, is 102.
Wow.
And, he's a Normandy vet in Sicily, North Africa, and the Normandy campaign. He got D-Day plus 30, so he came in with the Patton boys. But he got the hedgerows. And so as a young kid, I would listen to these stories of my grandfather. And I just got this. He never glorified combat. It wasn't a situation where he was telling me that this is, you know, something that is cool or combat is great. But it was a sense of this generational nobility that each American is asked to do. And if you can get through it, if you can experience it, your life has a completely different meaning. Family, peace, tranquility, it's never going to mean as much unless you go through the crucible of war. And so in the back of my head growing up, I just thought to myself, well, eventually I'm going to do this. You know, I'm going to get drafted or the Army's going to reach out and touch me. I wasn't, you know, the cycle of life took over, but I finally got to a point where my parents, I was home in college and we had a home invasion and these two drug addicts came into the house and terrorized my family and they were, you know, armed and they were stealing and robbing and I had a shot, you know, to defend my family, to defend, you know, as a grown, you know, as a college kid. And I didn't do it. And so I realized thinking back, well, you know, the Army's not going to reach out to get me. I gotta grow up and I've got to learn some lessons. And there was no war going on late 90s, peacekeeping in Bosnia and Kosovo. That was the big mission. So I signed up, become an infantryman. And, you know, that's what I felt my family business was. It was our legacy.
Well, to some extent, you wanted to see if you measured up.
I really, you know, you're absolutely right. I didn't understand that until, you know, there's a lot of, you go through, you know, you go through the Army in your youth and you don't really know what the world is like. And then you leave and you realize that ultimately in my life, that ultimately is the ultimate challenge of an adult is, am I leaving my uniform in a better place than I got it? Am I making my community better? Am I making my organization better? Do I measure? Am I needed? When we look at all the problems veterans go through when we get out, addiction, suicide, depression, it's all about whether or not they're needed. Do we have a purpose? Do we have validation? Is there someone out there that wants me as an integral part of a community and a team? And it's so hard to replace that fidelity. You know, as a civilian and being needed in a fight, being needed in a group is such an incredible experience that you chase that dragon for the rest of your life.
In fact, in David's most recent book, Remember the Ramrods, an Army Brotherhood in War and Peace, one of the lines I wrote down when reading it was, quote, proving to yourself why you are needed in the fight. And I thought that really struck a chord. And you mentioned your grandfather, but your family, your dad, was not in the military, was he?
No, my dad was a dentist. And there was a time before 9/11, you know, I'm the youngest of four, grew up in Buffalo, and everyone in my family, education, professional degrees, masters, PhDs. This was the lane you went to show that, you know, you were going to carry on the family tradition. No one wanted the dentistry, but my dad was eagerly hoping his last youngest son would do that. And so my dad was fixated on taking people out of discomfort, getting people out of pain, coming up with resolutions to conflict, you know, intellectually talking, discussing, you know, having discourse. And so he saw this move to the military as almost like it's a rebellion. Like, you know, why do you want to break things? Why do you want to train? Why do you want to fight? And it wasn't really until 9/11 when I think the country and most family members of people that were in the military at the time and veterans, I mean, even other, most the Vietnam veterans I talked to, I get all my wisdom from the Vietnam generation. They've been through everything we've been through. They had families. They had jobs. We don't need to look at a magic eight ball when we look at our future. We look at the Vietnam generation and think, look at the way these men and women have conducted themselves. This is our future. They're wonderful examples of that. But when I talk to those Vietnam vets, many of them didn't even get appreciated until 9/11. 9/11 wasn't just a generational fight. 9/11 was a generational thank you to service, whether it was law enforcement, first responders, or Vietnam veterans and current members. So after 9/11 happened, all of our families became like soccer moms. You know, like they were so proud that we chose this, that the war was happening, but we made the decision to want to do this. And so that relationship with my dad and my service completely changed, as it did for many sons and dads after September 11th.
Oh, absolutely. And you were sort of an interesting enlisted in the Army kind of guy. You were a non-drinker. You were a studier. You were a writer. You had a young son that had had medical issues who you missed dearly. You were a different kind of non-commissioned officer, as I read this and as I understand it. Can you explain to our listeners who maybe don't understand what the role of an NCO is to them?
Yeah, so the NCO is the backbone of the military. When we go to foreign countries and we try to rebuild, you know, armies, one of the things that Iraq and Afghanistan was sorely missing was an NCO corps, which is that connection between the officer and the enlisted soldier on the ground. And the NCO becomes almost a surrogate father. We conduct the training. We make sure that everyone is ready in their personal lives, in their professional lives. They're ready for the fight. They're ready for garrison. They're ready for life. This is our, you know, you've got the principal of a school who's your senior NCO and your command sergeant majors, your colonels, the teacher in the classroom is what the NCO is. We're with you all day. We want to make sure you're prepared and you're ready. And you take over that surrogate father role where, you know, you're tucking them to bed, you're making sure they're eating, you're making sure that they're healthy and they're making good decisions. And for the longest part, I didn't really know what I would look at a subordinate that was young and earnest and physically fit and super smart. And for a long time, I saw that as a threat. I think most civilians will see someone coming up as a, you know, well, this guy's going to take your job. He's better than you. And it didn't really dawn on me until combat that that's actually my purpose for living. As an NCO, I can only be judged by what my subordinates do better than me, that I have to be replaced. It's a necessity in our military that the current generation is more proficient and disciplined and professional than the previous generation. And so your job isn't to professionally goaltend the young kid coming up. Your job is to nurture it and break out that greatness inside of them. And well, once you realize that a leader is only judged by how their subordinates eclipse them, you start to understand the game and understand why we're here. And then you are a father. And because I had a little boy at home, that gestation was pretty natural.
Well, and you talk about in Remember the Ramrods, the role that you ultimately recognized, which was you were to bring out the best soldier in everybody, and everybody's different, and you're to bring out the best warrior in everybody, and there's a different way to do that with folks, whether they're follow the book or they're total screw-ups, there's still a great soldier inside. And that part I also found very interesting as you wrote. But I want to – you were in the Army for 6 years, I believe. And,
yes.
And your first book was House to House. And can you just talk a little bit about that, and then we'll roll into the current book, Remember the Ramrods.
So House to House was a book – there was a generation of Global War on Terror veteran that came home in the first wave. And we were writing books basically because we felt that a lot of civilians didn't know what we were actually fighting. You had two wars simultaneously going on, Afghanistan and Iraq, and politics subsumes all of that. You've got good wars and bad wars. Iraq was the war of choice, the war that was based on bad intelligence. Afghanistan was avenging 9/11 and getting to the important parts of why we were at war as a generation. And so to me, I read so much of, you know, from remarks you know, All Quiet on the Western Front to all the classics that came from World War II and Vietnam and Caputo's Rumor of War and Hackworth and Officers and Enlisted. And there really was no genre of book that talked about that small unit relationship in a deep dive as to what actually combat is like, trying to make it realistic, but also trying to show that this is, we've got to be super cautious when we go to war. There's a cost in it. And I don't think at the time I wrote House to House in 2006-07 that I understood that cost. I understood as the maturity and the distance it takes to look back. We change. And when we try to fight that change, combat transforms us permanently. And you can resist it, you can deny it, you can put it off and kick it down the road. Ultimately, it rears its ugly head in almost every aspect of life. It will rear its ugly head everywhere. So you can be a victim of the trauma, or you can be empowered by the trauma. And so how do we conduct ourselves? Are we living for people that we lost? Are we sacrificing and being a better individual because of people that we didn't bring home? Or are we going to be entombed by that and be a victim of that? And I think it takes sometimes 20 years for you to kind of look back and do an inventory and say, well, here are the mistakes I made. Here are the things that are working out.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
And I want to point that out, that it was in November of 2004 when the Second Battle of Fallujah is raging, and you have to ultimately clear this house. That activity initially got you the award of the Silver Star, which was subsequently upgraded to the Medal of Honor in 2019. But you wrote House to House in 2007. So it's just 3 years after this, and the time for reflection, the time to maybe see all of the impacts of that trauma from war, maybe hadn't all come to the surface yet, David.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's a lot. Well, the other thing, too, is that, you know, it was such a weird experience to – I never knew that I was nominated for the Medal of Honor. It was the media that was telling everyone in 2004, 5, 6 that I was nominated for the Medal of Honor. So – I didn't really, I thought it was going to happen. It was just a matter of time. These are big investigations. Then I hear about this reporter who filmed the event, and there's a tape out there. And now I'm thinking, well, what's on the tape? Maybe what was on the tape was so horrible that, you know, it didn't work out with my version. But the Medal of Honor is an award that they don't interview. They don't care what you think you saw or did. The only thing that can go in a Medal of Honor award process is what other people witnessed. So if you engage two individuals, but no one saw it happen, it didn't happen. It's not in the citation.
Absolutely.
The only thing that's in the citation is the evidence of something that happened from two people, not one, but two. So you need two witnesses. So my biggest problem was that, you know, what had been witnessed was only on a tape with a foreign journalist. And you know, I figured, well, this is just, it's never going to happen. It's not the end of the world. My award was coming home and being with my family.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah.
No, the mere fact that this Australian journalist was embedded and was, and he's only got a few minutes of tape on this, but it's, helps demonstrate the chaos under which everybody is operating. And I think it's really helpful for the general public to understand this isn't the Medal of Honor isn't something you raise your hand and say, I'd like to get, and I did really cool stuff. It's a whole.
So the tape is 29 minutes long. The documentary that he made, Only the Dead, that went on HBO, and that's really the 5-6 minutes that he put in that documentary. But it was apparent to me, and, you know, the Army doesn't tell you anything about the process. It's very opaque. It's very cloak and dagger. You don't know who voted, who did what, who said. You're kept out of everything. But it's very apparent to me that people saw the full tape. And the questions that came from the Army and the investigations that are done that someone had access to that because they have information that no one really would have. And it is certainly not from my book, and it's not from me. It's from what was on the tape. So in a way, it's a weird experience to know that the world is watching something that you thought didn't, they're watching the videotape of you and you didn't know it existed. And then at the same time, you realize, well, without that videotape, my unit, my friends, myself, none of us get the recognition without that videotape. So it's that double-edged sword that, you know, we love Michael Ware because of what he did and what he provided for our unit.
One of the things that people I don't think understand, again, that this is not something you volunteer to be a Medal of Honor winner, a recipient, and unfortunately most of them do it and end up deceased as a result of their activity. But usually there's somebody promoting this on your behalf. Was it the Army? Was it somebody at the unit level? Was it journalists? How did, and I kind of refer to them as the Medal of Honor Sherpas, somebody helps carry this package through this elaborate process, and you might come out the other end of that process, but somebody does a whole lot of work, don't they?
They do. And honestly, the question I get asked the most is, if you could do it all over again, would you do it? And my answer is no, 100% no. And I don't mean that because I don't love my guys. I don't love, you know, my Army. This is way too much to put on one person, to be the only living recipient of a war that had 4 million American men and women fighting in is not at all reasonable. It's unsustainable. There's way too many boxes that you could be put in. You get a lot of, it's just not something I ever wanted for myself. Honestly, I wouldn't want it for someone else either. So it's not a fun process, and it's not something you wake up every day and think, wow, this is so great, I'm going to coast through life. It's actually a burden that is more difficult than serving. I'd rather have an apartment in Fallujah than wear this thing every single day, because the expectations are unrealistic of what you expect to see from a recipient. But you're absolutely right. There are always people. And again, these awards are the currency of combat, right? You can do things as a unit and as a leader, but unless you have a Bronze Star, Silver Star, Distinguished Service Cross, a Medal of Honor, a Presidential Unit Citation, these are what encapsulates the moment when you were tested. And so it's not just an individual that you're trying to put out there. You're trying to put out there that all of your guys did special things. If you're going to give this guy the Medal of Honor, that Bronze Star you gave that kid, maybe that's the Distinguished Service Cross. Maybe that's a Silver Star. Look at what these young people did. And, you know, and so mine was Doug Walter, who was my company commander. My other commander was killed in Fallujah, and that was Sean Sims. So knowing that Sean Sims, you know, before he died, acknowledged that this was something that was worthy of attention, knowing that, you know, journalists and other people were telling this story. Sometimes that story gets out of control and it's not really what happened, but it's a good story. And sometimes the Army kind of wants to promote things that aren't exactly, you know, based in 100% reality. But Walter, Doug Walter and Peter Smith and Peter Newell and my division, they all were like, hey, you know, I know it's been 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but put this thing up against anything you're currently looking at. And I don't think until that videotape or documentary comes out there that I don't think people believed it, honestly. I mean, we get a lot of people tell stories, and sometimes the fish is 2 inches long, and sometimes at the end of 10 years, that fish is a whale.
We call that false failure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So maybe people didn't believe it. It was too unbelievable. And I get it. But at the same time, I would rather people not believe the story than, you know, be the only guy on an island, because it's a lot to kind of, every time Iraq is in the news or every time something happens in the war on terror, you know, what side are you on? Everyone is going to want a peace. The Army wants a peace. Politicians want a peace. Everyone wants something out of the recipient, because if the recipient says the policy has failed, it gives it more credibility somehow, and it doesn't make sense. It's not real. The Vietnam guys had 80, you know, peers from different sides of the fight over, you know, 10 years. The Afghanistan guys are 22 of them from all over, from 2002, and the SEALs and Army and Marines. And there needs to be more recipients from Iraq so that we can tell the entire story of what our generation did at war.
Tell us why you wrote Remember the Ramrods.
I was at a point where I think for all of us, veterans in particular, we get to the point where we start hearing the guys that drop off the map. There are guys that take their own lives. There are guys that just want to be left. They want to put the war behind them. And we kind of forget that we're NCOs and we're soldiers forever. And I just wanted to put this whole – I was at a point in my life where no one brought up the Army ever. I'd established myself in a career. Nobody cared that I was a veteran. I wasn't low crawling to the copier. I wasn't, you know, getting the short haircut. I wasn't bringing attention to service. It was just, this is who I am and this is what I do. And when this, all of this attention came my way, I thought, you know, I went through it with these guys. What is it that we're all missing? For years, I thought that I missed the war. I thought war was what I needed in my life to feel complete and whole. And it dawned on me going through this process that the war isn't what I miss at all. I miss the people. I miss the men. I miss the relationships. I miss the sense of purpose and obligation and duty. And I can have that again without going to war. I can have those relationships again. Why? What am I afraid of? Why not make this award about all of us? Why not get back to what we were? And if they're open to it, and they were, and the vast majority of these guys were like, I miss you. And I could say things to you at 40 I couldn't say at 20. We don't say we love each other when we're 20. We're too tough. But at 40, you could say you love another man. I miss you and I love you. Give me a hug. And that's where we're at in middle age, is we're able to tell each other how we feel. We miss each other. We want each other to be back. And it was such a healing, cathartic experience. And I thought to myself, you know, all these books that people write as veterans, what this is a good news story. We don't have to be alone. We don't have to go through these things alone. You're still an NCO. Go out there and be with your soldiers. Lead your soldiers again. Bring them together. Call them up. Have them in your life. And if they're struggling, help them back up just like you did, you know, 20 years ago.
There's really the message. There is really the message, David, that I got out of the book, and why the book is subtitled An Army Brotherhood in War and Peace. That's the message I think is powerful in Remember the Ramrods, is if you were in service and you had those connections, or you were the NCO, or you were the commander, get off the couch and reconnect with these guys. It's going to be fantastic. In your reunion, if you will, was kind of around the Medal of Honor ceremony, which is obviously extremely unique. But talk about how those 40 men came back together and began, maybe began healing, but certainly added to the healing that had been going on.
Well, first of all, when you reach out, we're all different. We are different socioeconomic backgrounds. We cancel each other's vote. We root for the different teams on Sunday. You know, we are a cross section of America. And yet we seem to get along. We seem to be able to work together. We disagree. We're passionate, but we love each other and we respect each other. And so I thought my entire destiny on this planet was to lead men in war, lead men across an objective. And when time goes by, you realize, well, your destiny is to be in someone's life, to impact their life. And they have such a huge, profound impact on my growth, on my matriculation to civilian life, on how, what kind of a father I am, what kind of a man I am. I would not be the person I am if it wasn't for the Army and it wasn't for the soldiers I served with. And it's tough to be getting a phone call out of 15 years later and saying, do you want to come to Washington and celebrate an individual? Do you want to, all the stuff that you want to put in a box, you threw it in your barn, you close the door, you put it in a time capsule. Do you want to unleash all of that and celebrate one guy? And if that's the way it was sold to them, I'm not sure I would want to do it. So we had to make this about us. This is not an individual award. It's a unit award. And I'm not just going to stand up there and you're going to clap. You're going to come on the stage with me. You're going to meet the president with me. You're going to be a part of everything I do. I'm going to have 40 guys and girls that I serve with and the parents of the fallen and the children of the fallen. And we're all going to do this as one big group. And that's how we, that was a promise I made when I brought them out there. And that's what we ended up doing. And it was such an amazing healing experience. They trusted me. And we're back in each other's lives now, and it's beautiful.
Well, this, your book portrays a lot about the backside of the Medal of Honor ceremony, which we in the general public get to see maybe a little news clip. Maybe we'll watch it longer on YouTube. But you really peel it back and say how you were feeling, what you were seeing, what you were doing. I want to comment on a couple of these things, that nuggets that you revealed, and maybe you want to comment on a couple of more. President Trump, who awarded this in June of 2019, before he signed the citation, asked you, do you want me to do this? What was your response?
I don't know. I didn't want anything to do with this. I've said no so many times that they had to break out. They had to break out my enlistment contract, and the enlistment contract is specific about the inactive ready reserve, how, the types of things
right,
the Army
right,
can do.
They can call you back. Yep, yep.
And it's small print. It's the recipient of the Medal of Honor. You can't say no. And so I was. Yeah, I didn't want it. Everything I knew everything was going to change, and I was comfortable in my little I loved my life, and it was void of that time.
David's got these three kids. He's successful in the radio business. He's what they call talent. I'm not. He is. You didn't need this. And I thought it was funny that you reported out, hey, I told him no, but, he did it anyway. Well, one of the other things, again, we in the public see this, there's a row of generals always and secretaries of defense or army or whoever. In your instance, as I said, you had a lot of the ramrods, maybe I think it was 40 guys and family members, your family members. You have this big, audience of 300 looking at you. Your boys kind of took it to a new level, didn't they? They were enthusiastic. Why don't you tell everybody about that?
There's the famous story of Andrew Jackson opening up the White House on Inauguration Day, and a bunch of hillbillies just like poured into the White House and started, drinking alcohol and stomping on furniture with their boots. These ramrods, I love these men. These guys are tough. They are, you don't want to mess with the 1st Infantry Division in a fight. They're salt of the earth, the fabric of America, from all city, rural, suburban, all walks of life, all demographics, ethnicities, sexualities. We got them all. They're beautiful, beautiful men. But my God, they turned that ceremony is very sterile. And it's like, this is all formal. And
I think the word the White House would say is solemn, not sterile.
It's solemn. It's solemn. It is a solemn ceremony. And they turned it into a rally. They turned it into, it was like a promotion ceremony outside the barracks. And it was a cool experience.
Well, and you report in the book, you write in Remember the Ramrods, that unusual energy played right into President Trump.
Trump was like in front of, he was like at a rally. And once he started feeding off the crowd and the crowd was laughing, he's walking to the crowd, he's high-fiving people. He literally took it to a whole new level. But as the citation's being read, I'm looking at these guys' faces, and the one thing I wasn't expecting is that, and I kind of forced them to go back in time, and not a lot of these guys necessarily wanted to.
The interview with David Bellavia went on for quite a while. We don't have time for it all today, and that's why we tell you to go back to veteransradio.net, to go to our podcast. Just put into any of your search engines, Veterans Radio, David Bellavia. His full interview will pop up. I think you'll find it interesting.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio, or back, I should say, to Veterans Radio, Michael Harris, President of the Michigan Paralyzed Veterans of America. Michael, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Jim. It's always enjoyable to be on your show.
Well, Michigan PVA nationally is really a leader in a lot of areas for veterans who've suffered, paralyzing injuries, either while in combat or in service or afterwards, and really you guys have been at the forefront of advocating all kinds of improvements to make a better quality of life. And it caught my eye that a recent law was signed in by the president called Advancing Uniform Transportation Opportunities for Veterans Act, also known as Auto for Veterans Act. And I thought, who better to explain what this is about than my friend Mike Harris? So, Mike, tell us what the Auto for Veterans Act does.
Well, you know, it's crazy. When the president signed it on January 9th of this year, what happened prior to the legislation is that a veteran received a one-time benefit of $22,000 towards the purchase of their vehicle if they were 100% disabled, like our members were, you know, with a spinal cord injury and or disease, which requires the use of a wheelchair for mobility. And so we've been advocating for this for a long time to increase that to every 10 years. And so what happened is that because they wanted to make it cost neutral, they decided to compromise. And so the first grant will go out to our members who applied for 30 years or longer, which will most of our members will still qualify for the grant. And then it will phase into veterans every 10 years will eventually be able to get this grant going forward. And the amount's going to be about the same, about $22,300. And it will also define the types of specialized equipment that the grant can be applied for. So that they've changed the definition of medical services. So it's really a win for us and for our members. And we,
well, this is one of those things where, you know, and you mentioned it, it had to be cost neutral. So it doesn't go all the way, but as far as it should, but that's pretty much true with legislation as you've experienced over the years anyway. And I think for those who don't realize what modified vehicles are about for those with mobility problems and the cost of it, I mean, $22,000 is not going to go very far when the cost of modifying a vehicle, say a van that you have to pull a wheelchair, a powerized wheelchair into, it can be like $80,000 on that vehicle, can it?
Yeah, you know, even though the veteran, you know, they do, and I believe it's called the Special Adapted Equipment Grants, you know, for service-related, they get the conversion items whenever they do purchase a new vehicle. And that, as you said, that can be quite expensive. I'm in the process of purchasing a new vehicle myself this year, and my injury is not service connected, and my costs are going to be about $40,000 just for me, and that doesn't include the cost of the vehicle.
Right, that's what I was trying to get to. That's the conversion price, not the vehicle price. We hope you enjoyed that interview with Mike Harrison. Learned a little bit about the challenges for those who are 100% service disabled and they have mobility issues and trying to convert their vehicles into something they can use. We had a much longer interview. Again, you can find it at veteransradio.net and search for Michael Harris, MPVA, and you'll find that podcast. Hang on, we got one more for you. Before we get there, I want to thank our VSO sponsors, the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter, the Graf O'Hara VFW Post 423, the American Legion Irwin Preskin Post 46, and the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, and as always, our friends at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. And now we'll get to the NVBDC spotlight. Welcome, I am Jim Fossone, and this is Veterans Radio Spotlight on National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. As you know, if you've been listening, Veterans Radio America has a partnership with NVBDC, and we often bring you information that they want passed along. The National Veteran Business Development Council is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses, really of all sizes. It's a 501c3 nonprofit established in 2013, and it addresses the growing need to identify and certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses for the government and commercial marketplace. NVBDC administers a rigorous certification process designed to withstand the scrutiny of corporate and governmental entities seeking to utilize certified veteran-owned businesses. And their CEO asked that we here at Veterans Radio interview and talk with an artist, Jason Jones. Jason, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're great to have you, and this comes out of Keith King at NVBDC asking if he could use one of the songs that you recently released at a national conference that NVBDC was holding with its business partners. He was so really moved by the song and this experience, he said, hey, Jim, you got to talk to Jason. So, Jason, that's how we get here. Tell us a little bit about your background as an artist, a songwriter, a musician. Give us the thumbnail.
Well, I come from a musical family, and I've just been around music, you know, all my life. My mom is a concert pianist. She played with symphony orchestras. My cousin is a guitar player. And I just got into it at a really young age, and it's just been a great outlet for me to express myself.
Well, you are a creative type, and that's, you know, one of those things that you can bring out in your creativity is sorting feelings and emotions through music. As an L.A. native, you somehow got yourself around. Tell us about the frame of mind for how you wrote and thought about this new song, For the Heroes, which came out in front of Veterans Day 2022.
Well, what happened was during COVID, I saw what the first responders were going through and how scary it was. I come from a military family. My brother's in the Air Force. My sister joined the Army. Another brother, naval officer. And I just saw their struggles and what they go through, and I just wanted to find a way to say thank you, pretty much. There were just different circumstances that were just close to my heart, and the song just pretty much wrote itself.
Well, it takes us. I love the humility of guys who say, took care of itself. It's just normal business. Yeah, it's more than that. I recognize it. But it's interesting that the artistic part of this that you brought to the table had already been impacted or formed in some way because of your brother and your sister's services. And quite frankly, you got most of the services covered in the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. Did you realize that was kind of all seeping into your DNA?
It's a big part of who I am. My grandparents, they taught for NATO, and through them I was around a lot of military personnel, and I'd visit my brother on base once in a while. Air Force brother and my Navy brothers. So I pretty much got a real good snapshot into what their lives are like. And when they came out of the service, I think that the National Veterans Business Development Council really touched me because I see so many veterans out there. You know, they come out of the service and they need a helping hand. And I think that the National Veterans Business Development Council is just a great place for them to find what they need, you know, to grow and start their own businesses. So
yeah.
I'm just 100% on board for it.
Well, and we talk about this, that when you're in the military, your network of people is in the military. And one of the challenges is when you get out, you don't have that same network anymore. You know, other guys have spent 4 or 8 or 12 years developing a business network, but you were in the military serving, so you don't have that network. And you probably see that in the music business. You've been in it your whole life. You've got a network of folks that you can turn to. It, just as those starting businesses who are veterans can turn to NVBDC and help develop a network that otherwise maybe doesn't exist for them. So we're talking to Jason M. Jones. Jason, what describe for us the style of music you normally write and play and then transition into this particular song for the Heroes, which I think has a bit of a different spin.
Well, I've been writing a lot of music for film and TV as a composer. I played out live quite a bit with a band called Humanity. And I just personally just really started getting into country music because it really tells stories with the lyrics. And it just, the more I would listen, the more it would touch my heart because it's so down to earth and so real. And so I just became a country fan, and this song just kind of wrote itself and came out in the country vein.
Yeah, I thought maybe it would like hit that from, because it's, as you say, country music is all about storytelling. And as a guy from the city of Detroit, Motown, but when I got in service, some of my buddies turned me on to country, and now decades later, I'm a country music fan. And I listened to this and read the words, and I said, man, this rings country. I'm wondering if Jason M. Jones is like this. I always write country, or this one just had to be country.
It just came out like that, you know. It just like I said, it just pretty much wrote itself.
For those of us who are in awe that you guys have the talent to do this, what comes first, the lyrics, the chords, the melody? How does this get assembled together?
Well, it's not always the same path that leads to the destination. In this case, I literally just started writing, and I just started thinking about, you know, I have a close friend that is a veteran that is actually going for treatment at the Veterans Hospital at the VA. And I saw how he came out of the service, and he's really going through some stuff emotionally, but he's really a good guy. And so that's kind of where that started as far as the first part of the lyrics. And I started thinking on a larger scope about how the world is in such turmoil. Everyone's talking about war and not talking about peace anymore. Everyone just seems to be ramped up to fight. And I just think, you know, we need a worldwide blessing. We just need more peace in the world. And I'm grateful for the military, because without the military, we wouldn't have any peace. We would just have absolute chaos in this world, because there's just a lot of bad actors out there.
Oh, absolutely. And there's many in the who view their job in the military as peacekeepers, but they're the ones who keep the evil away from the door. And you have a line that I want you to talk a little bit about in the song For the Heroes. And the line is, "This is for the heroes that you never see on TV, the unsung heroes, everyday celebrities."
Well, You know, that's exactly what it is. It's those people that are the real celebrities. The real celebrities are not the people that you're seeing on television all the time that you have corporations pushing. It's the people that every day are in the trenches risking their lives for us. It's those people that are going into the fires and pulling people out and risking their own lives. And some of them, unfortunately, even lose their lives to save others. And that's what it's all about. I think more attention needs to be given to those everyday people, those everyday heroes.
Absolutely. And as you say, unsung heroes, sending a worldwide message. We need a worldwide blessing. Jason M. Jones, if people want to read more about you or follow along or find some of your music, just the way NVBDC said, hey, man, reach out. This guy's got something to tell. He's got a great story to tell us. Where do folks reach out?
Well, they can look under Jason M. Jones on Spotify, Amazon, Apple Music, and most digital outlets. They can find my music. Just look for For the Heroes and Jason M. Jones, and I think you'll find me.
Well, that's great, and we encourage people to do that. As we end the interview, we're going to exit with playing For the Heroes by Jason M. Jones. He's allowed us to do that, and we really appreciate it. Jason, thanks for the time today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Never gave a dime. Came home from the war out of his mind. Stays drunk and high. Still a good guy. Ran into the firing line and pulled aside in the nick of time. This is for the heroes that you never see on. Celebrities.
That's Jason M. Jones, tribute to everyday heroes for our military and our first responders, and we really appreciate NVBDC making him available to us, and you can always check them out at nvbdc.org. We do Veterans Radio for the everyday heroes, the regular guys and gals who are never going to make it on TV, but they're heroes nonetheless in the service of their country. So we hope that you've enjoyed the programs that we've been able to bring you today. A recognized hero like David Bellavia, from Medal of Honor recipient, to Michael Harris, and all the good work done by PVA locally and nationally. And then brought to us by NVBDC, Jason Jones, an artist who has some great reflections on what people do in the military and first responders. So we want to thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. Follow us on Facebook and look us up at veteransradio.net. Catch our podcasts and see what else we're telling folks about. You can always support us there as well. This program has been on the air for 20 years, and it's only because of the generous support of individuals and our corporate sponsors. So we are constantly in need of that help. Next week, Dale Thronberry, the helicopter pilot and founder of Veterans Radio, will be back with some interesting programs to talk and people to talk about. So there's always something to come back for all across the nation. And as I say, you can keep track of us on the internet. We do a lot there as well. So until next time, you are dismissed.